Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff, and sorry about the little echo there. Hi, I hope that's better now. So this is The Powerful Patient, and I'm Joyce Graff, and we're so glad that you're with us today. I'd like to introduce my co-host, Robin Martinez, who is the lead support person for SmartPatients.com. Welcome, Robin.
Hi, Joyce. It's great to be here today.
Great. And we have a special guest today to talk with us about Batten disease, which is one of a class of diseases called lysosomal storage disease. And if you've seen the pictures that go with the podcast, we have a couple of slides going by that will describe a little bit what the lysosome is, a component of every cell. And in it, there are, it sort of collects garbage and takes care of moving the garbage out. And when that mechanism is broken in any of a number of ways, it causes problems. So we'll talk a little bit about Batten disease and the particular issue that people are dealing with there. So welcome, Noreen Murphy from the Batten Disease Support and Research Association. Welcome, Noreen.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. So I understand you are the Director of Education and Support?
I am. I work mostly on creating education pieces for our patients and families who are dealing with Batten disease. So the materials are generally help them understand not only the science behind Batten disease, but also we have education resources to help them in school, and then also connect them with experts who can help them with behavioral problems or getting resources for their home, like modifications for their cars and those sorts of things.
Right. So tell us a little bit about the family experience of Batten disease. What happens in a family?
Sure. So there are... we have 14 different forms of Batten disease that have been discovered so far, and they all have very similar symptoms, but the onset of those symptoms is different, which can sort of change the way a family experiences Batten disease. So for some forms, symptom onset is very early on after birth, and those symptoms can start with seizures, and then there's loss of mobility and blindness. So for the very early forms, a lot of times those go undiagnosed while the child is alive because the progression is so fast. But then if they are diagnosed while the child is alive, there's not a lot that can happen right away. But then there are forms where these symptoms sort of begin at somewhere around 2 or 3, and that usually starts with a loss of language. So if you have, if your child is 2 and is progressing normally and has this handful of words, they start to lose those words. And that's sort of paired with also an onset of seizures. So for those families...
So let me back you up for just a minute. So you have this baby, and the baby looks perfectly normal and seems to be wonderful and perfect. And you take the baby home and think... they progress normally, they meet some early milestones, and then things begin to go bad, right?
Correct. And it's sort of, and I guess the what's hard about that is, children progress at totally different, at different rates. So if you have a language delay, a lot of times doctors will either say, especially with boys, boys progress slower than girls. Or are you sure they had those words before they started to delay? So that's hard. There's also a lot of misdiagnosis at that point. A lot of our patients are diagnosed with sometimes autism. Once the seizures start, they'll be diagnosed with a sort of general epilepsy rather than Batten disease. So we have a lot of our patients sort of go through a lot of different diagnoses before they land on Batten disease.
So help me out with this. If I understand this correctly, this is one of those diseases that if we know early on that a child has this particular problem, is there a way that changing the diet might help or something like that? I know there are a number of things that are screened for in that first blood spot test that babies go through when they are still in the hospital to try to identify metabolic disorders that can cause havoc if they're not identified early. Is this one of the ones that we look for in that test?
It is not. Batten disease is not yet on the newborn screening panel, though we're hopeful that at some point it will be for all forms of Batten disease. And it is one, in general, any sort of disease that's like this where the faster you can catch it when there is a treatment, the better the results are going to be. However, Batten disease does not have an approved treatment that will eliminate all symptoms. There are things that can be prescribed. There are certain kinds of seizure medicines that might help with symptoms, but there's no treatment or cure for Batten disease.
So there's no treatment or cure. If a family knows that there is Batten disease in the family, so, and just to back up one minute here, this is a recessive disorder, right? So that both parents have to have one copy of the Batten disease gene that is not working, and which is something that not everybody is likely to know about themselves, right?
True. If no one in your family that you know of has ever had Batten disease, because none of them have ever been with another person who has a carrier of Batten disease, you would never know for generations and generations and generations. So one thing that we do try and help our patients once they do is to make sure that their family is aware so that cousins and siblings, they can all be tested to see if they're carriers along with their partners.
Right, because we know now how to check it, but 20 years ago we didn't know how to check for it, right?
Correct.
So the likelihood that someone would have had a clear diagnosis of Batten disease 10, 20 years ago is probably pretty low. Is that true?
It was all based on symptoms before rather than on going in and actually doing a genetic test. Right now, we say we have 14 forms that have been discovered. It used to be they had sort of four versions of Batten disease that they would talk about. You had infantile, you had late infantile, juvenile, and the adult onset. So we now know that there are different genetic reasons behind each of those, and that there are more than four.
Right. But it's only in the last 20 years that we've known to look for and identify genes at all. What were you saying, Robin?
I was asking, so now they can identify people who are carriers, even though they have no visible signs of the disease. Is that correct?
That is correct. And the carrier test is, if you know what form is in your family history, so if your niece was diagnosed and so you have her results, it's as simple as a saliva test. That can decide if you are a carrier of that specific type.
Great. I know 20 years ago a lot. I'm sorry, Robin, go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying saliva test sounds great. That's so easy and non-invasive. That's wonderful.
Yeah, it was very exciting. Mm-hmm. We do some carrier testing at our family conference, and last year was the first year we were able to do the saliva test instead of a blood draw. So everyone was pretty excited about that.
Yeah, I know in the old days people often didn't talk about these newborn tragedies. When you lose a baby under a year, it becomes a tragedy that hangs around in the certainly in the mother's life and the father's life, but the relatives often know very little about it. So chasing down a family history can be hard. But once there's been a child diagnosed with Batten disease, if you do share that information within a family, then someone else in the family might be alerted to the fact that they should get this kind of testing and sort of discover in advance whether this is a risk factor they need to be concerned about.
Mm-hmm.
How do you educate families along that line?
We offer discounted sibling carrier testing, which is a way to sort of help prompt them to get their other children tested to see if they're carriers. And that can be sort of when you find out the diagnosis of your affected child, or it can be, you know, we have families contacting us. Their siblings are now older and they're getting married and thinking about having children of their own and they would like to be tested. So that's one way that we try and encourage it. By sort of taking away that price barrier, because it can be sort of expensive for families, especially if you're having multiple children tested to get these tests done. And then a lot of it is just through education. We host private Facebook chats for caregivers and parents, and the one that we're doing this evening is based all around the genetics of Batten disease to help educate them on what it means to be a carrier, how they passed it on to their child, and then also how that could affect the rest of their family going out, you know, as far as second, third cousins, however far out they want to go.
Right, because it seems to me it's not only a matter of other children in your own family, but your own sisters and brothers are probably also of childbearing age. And might appreciate being alerted at that point, right?
Yeah.
Did you have an outreach to the parents' siblings?
We don't directly reach out, mostly because we don't have contact information for them, But it seems as though with families sort of in this era, they are much more open with their direct family. We get contacted by a lot of aunts and uncles of an affected child just because they want to learn more because they heard about it from their sibling that this is what's happening in their life. So I think that it just is a little bit more known. People are a lot more willing to talk about it with their families. But we don't have a direct aunt and uncle outreach program.
Sure. No, I was just wondering if you had something like a brochure that I could give to my sister that might be a gentle way of saying you might want to get this test.
We don't, but that's a great idea.
Okay.
That is a great idea.
So I know you said we don't have an approved therapy for it, but I think there is some work going on in research, right? So tell us a little bit about research progress for Batten disease and other similar disorders here.
Sure. We have a lot of research going right now, which is very exciting. A lot, specifically because a lot of it is moving into what will be clinical trials. So we have an enzyme replacement therapy trial happening right now that's, you know, it's still in its trial phase. It has not been approved or not approved by the FDA yet, but that is moving for CLN2, which is generally a late infantile form of Batten disease. We also have gene therapy research being done in CLN6, CLN1, and CLN3. Those are all in the very early stages. CLN1 and CLN3 haven't, you know, they're not even at the point of recruiting patients yet. So it's very early. Mm-hmm. But we also have, for the research, they do sort of basic research in the lab, and then they build animal models to test, the treatments on the animal models. And those range from a yeast strain to a mouse to you have to have a large animal model before you can go into clinical trials. So we actually have a lot of research in all of the forms and a lot of animal models in all of the forms, which is a really great step towards being able to move that research from the lab to a clinical trial. So we have large animal forms for most of the forms of Batten disease.
So help us understand, because if I have this right, here you have this beautiful newborn baby who looks perfect and is perfect in all but one teeny little area. And it's actually most of the functioning in this child is going along wonderfully well. But because the lysosome is missing some little enzyme, it helps it to get rid of waste products when they're no longer needed in the cell. The accumulation of waste in the cell is what's doing the damage, right?
Yes.
So one way or another, for all of these conditions, we need to teach the cell how to kick out the trash, basically.
Yeah, the way I've heard this is a really, neat way to describe this. I heard one of our parents talking about how she talks about it with the unaffected siblings. About what's happening. She describes it as if all of the trashmen in the city stopped picking up the trash and just started piling up and piling up so that no one could go about and do their jobs properly. That's what's happening. The cell's no longer allowed, able to function the way that it should be because of this pile up of the sort of garbage in the cell.
Right, and
it
causes degradation
disease.
Of neurological function, right?
Yes, and so that's sort of where it causes seizures, blindness, and then Batten disease is one of the most common forms of childhood dementia as well.
Now, there are a lot of lysosomal storage disorders, aren't there?
There are.
How hard or easy is it to differentiate among them? What should parents be looking for?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I don't know a whole lot about all of the other forms of all of the other different types of lysosomal storage disorders. I think that they all have very different symptoms. Some similar, but they all have their own unique set of symptoms.
Oh, as I understand it, the big thing to watch out for is if your baby is no longer meeting their milestones. If they start out making good progress and then the progress seems to go backwards, or as you say, seizures and other clearly serious issues that you need to take immediately to the pediatrician or the hospital. It just be alert for those kinds of things, because the parent is with the baby a lot more than the pediatrician is, and the parent is going to notice he knew how to do that last month, and now he didn't know how to do it anymore.
I think that there's also all lysosomal storage diseases in general are going to be progressive. So you're going to see, if you see a symptom. And even if you're diagnosed with, say, epilepsy, if that's sort of progressively getting worse over time, that's something to watch out for, because it might not just be epilepsy. Or if epilepsy, if seizures are the first thing that you see, but you progress into other things like loss of words or some loss of mobility or something like that, that's another thing to look out for to see if what's happening with your child is progressively getting worse.
Are there vision deficiencies with Batten's?
There are. In nearly all forms of Batten disease, you're going to have vision problems. In some, it's a more prominent issue, particularly if that's an early symptom. So for the CLN3 children who generally have a juvenile presentation, blindness is one of the first symptoms. So it's kind of a bigger issue because it's one of the first things that happens in the child, generally even before seizures or any sort of loss of mobility.
Because it is one of the first symptoms, is that more likely to lead to misdiagnosis, do you think?
I think it is. Those patients, a lot of them have sort of their first diagnosis is vision and eye related. For that particular disease, behavior problems also sort of come along at the same time. So there are a lot of times coupled in autism diagnosis with a blindness diagnosis. So it's sort of, that is one of the first things that come together, and it's not until those things get progressively worse or you add in additional symptoms that they kind of come around to a Batten disease diagnosis.
Well, you said there are 14 different kinds. Are these really differences in the age of onset and the severity of the condition, or is there more to it than that?
Well, we say 14 different kinds because there are 14 different sort of gene mutations that have been identified.
Okay.
Some of them
right.
look very similar to each other, but because the gene mutation is in a different spot, they're causing whether slightly or largely different things to happen in the brain. So when we're looking
right.
at treatments and cures, knowing those different gene mutations are very important towards finding out exactly what's happening in the cells.
Right, and it's a partnership really between the research, the technical part, the where is the blip on the gene and exactly what enzyme is getting tweaked in what direction. But then there's also the matter of the symptomology, what is the experience, the family experience of this disease. And I think for all these lysosomal storage disorders, the earlier we can realize what we're dealing with, the better it is. And none of these are wonderful because, as you say, they really don't have much in the way of treatment. But if we realize it earlier, we're more likely to, and there's tremendous research going on. There are some clinical trials, as I understand it, that are about to start up for Batten disease, one of the lysosomal storage disorders that has more of a hope of a cure on the horizon here than many of them do. So I would, you know, encourage parents to go to the pediatrician and maybe even, you know, if you suspect this, really press them to do some genetic testing, because we really need to know what ball game you're playing in order to be able to win it.
Absolutely.
That's very well.
And with the treatments and cures that have come out in other diseases and I guess treatments in other diseases, and then also research that's been done in our animal models, it's very clear that, you know, it's very hard to near impossible to reverse the damage done.
That's right.
Once
the damage
is
established,
yeah.
you can't get it back. So you need to try to catch it before it's too severe. And you said behavioral problems, and I think one of the issues that sometimes happens is that if a child is showing behavioral problems, then people most likely go to psychological, or he's being stubborn, or he's not cooperative. And I think we need to trust our children and our own instincts about it and say, let's check first for some underlying physical cause. If there's an underlying physical cause, we need to deal with that first. And I know I deal with that in pheochromocytoma, which is an adrenal problem also, which will make the kid look like he's got ants in his pants and is being obstreperous, you know. But we need to really think about, have I talked to the pediatrician about this? Don't be shy. Bring it up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that we see a lot of the sort of behavioral problems with our kids stem from starting to lose vision. And if they're not able to communicate that that's what's happening, it can be very scary for them and they can act out.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, there's a loss of mobility and balance issue. So if a child can't do the things that they think that they should be able to do or that their friends do, that can become very frustrating.
Right.
And then having, you know, that start of dementia where they're starting to lose memories and they don't understand where they are can also really affect their behavior in certain spaces.
Right. Robin, what other insights
found...
did you offer to families?
I'm thinking of the horrible difficulty of having this suspicion that something really is wrong with your child, but you go to the doctor And the doctor says, oh, it's really not that serious, or it's probably this, or gives you a firm diagnosis that you can live with, and you don't pursue your gut instinct that, no, I think there's more going on here. What kind of advice can you give to parents about following their gut feelings, maybe recording symptoms as they happen or things like that, so that they can make a more convincing case to their pediatrician that something more needs to be done?
I think you're absolutely right that recording and taking photos is important, especially when it comes to things like seizures, because, you know, it could take weeks until you're able to see your doctor, and then your memory is a little, it's not as sharp as it was as it was happening. So having that recording or picture of what happened that was concerning you is really important. And then the other thing that I would like, you know, to remind parents is that you are the expert on your child. The doctor might be a medical expert, but on your child, you are the expert. So standing up for what you have observed and the feelings that you have are important. It's hard, but it's an important part of helping your child.
Right, and not only is it hard, it's scary, because you'd really like for it to be nothing more than retinitis pigmentosa, which is horrible
mm-hmm.
enough, but at least it has limits.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, we hear a lot from our parents who, you know, it gets a little easier over time to stand up for yourself in the doctor's office just because you're practiced at it. But we do, a lot of parents will call in and they'll want to, you know, they have an appointment next week and they just want to sort of talk through it. And we're just here to, you know, help you prepare. If you want, you know, have questions or if you want confirmation, if, you know, what you're doing is right. So that's a, you know, we're here to help with that as well. If they just want to talk about it. But we do that a lot also with sort of IEPs for, you know, when your child is in school and making sure they're getting everything they need in the classroom, with diseases that get progressively, mm-hmm. You progressively lose skills. It's hard. IEPs are hard because they're very much focused on gaining. And if your child's not going to gain anything, it's hard to sort of set up with your school that IEP and make sure that they're aware that that's not, you know, those aren't the important parts for your child. Gaining anything isn't, but maybe retaining words is.
Yeah.
Right. So what kind of a specialist should one take one's child to? If the local pediatrician is saying, oh, well, you know, every child has his own time clock, let's not
mm-hmm.
worry too much about this. And if you feel that that you're not being listened to properly, do you need to go to a major medical center and find a geneticist to work with? What do you tell parents?
I think that and they generally end up there anyway, but going to a neurologist, they're going to have they'll know more about neurological diseases and be able to sort of have a better chance of spotting one. There are centers that have, within their center, they'll have a neurologist. They'll have specialists in different areas, and they'll have occupational and physical therapists, and they'll have sort of a whole team built around helping not only diagnose but treat your child. A lot of major medical institutes have their own geneticists as a part of the, you know, sort of team of people who are working there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that could be a good way to be referred to someone in order to get the genetic test done.
Right, and if people say, oh, I can't afford that, I mean, come on, it's hard enough to go to the pediatrician. There usually are state programs like the CHIP program that will help you with costs for pediatric care. Is that true?
Yes, that is true. We, you know, and a lot of our families go through sort of a CHIP or a Medicare, Medicaid sort of situation to get sort of funds for those sorts of things.
Right, because we want every child to have as good a start as possible and be healthy for the rest of their life. And so, and this is not the only possible thing that could be wrong with a child. Sometimes they're easily corrected. This one's not so easily corrected. But in all cases, the earlier you find out what's going on, the more a hope there is for fixing it. Is that true?
Absolutely.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate your being with us, and we hope that everybody's baby turns out to be a very healthy person for their whole life, and we certainly want to see progress in these lysosomal storage diseases and other similar genetic flaws, teeny little flaws, that one day we will understand exactly how to turn on or replace some of these enzymes and fix these problems early. So it's important for all of us to work to diagnose them and to encourage research to be able to fix them as soon as possible, right?
Absolutely.
So,
and if anyone has any questions about Batten disease, they can feel free to reach out to us on our website, which is www.bdsra.org.
Great. Batten Disease Support and Research Association, BDSRA.org. Thanks again, and thank you, Robin, as always, for being with us. And thanks to all our listeners for being with us today. Thanks so much for joining us, and we hope that you'll join us again for another program on The Powerful Patient. And meanwhile, be well and be a powerful patient. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.